The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
This was the sound in Mexico City yesterday. As the ground began to shake violently, explosions and buildings falling down. The capital experienced a 7.1 magnitude earthquake. It was prolonged and it was violent. As of this morning, rescuers are still working to dig people out from under the rubble. Here's what we know today. 240 people have been reported dead, but there will be many more. The number is expected to rise. More than 40 buildings have already collapsed, including at least two schools. In a strange turn of events, what made yesterday so weird and jarring was that many Mexicans had attended memorial services earlier that morning. They had been to church because they were marking the 32nd anniversary of the 1985 earthquake that killed 10,000. This earthquake also came less than 2 weeks after an 8.1 magnitude that killed 91 people and destroyed thousands of homes. Mexico City is one of the greatest cities, I believe, in the Western Hemisphere. It's a clean New York. It is a great cultural city. And in the rubble, we saw something else. We saw the strength of the human spirit. We saw neighbor helping neighbor, a community coming together. And in the coming days, we'll see what makes America great yet again. We will see Americans reaching deep and helping their neighbor. Because no matter what we say, there is never a wall around our hearts. Yesterday, what we saw in Mexico was a nation move to action when everybody focused on what really mattered most, each other. For two countries that are throwing the war of words back and forth with our politicians, it was interesting to watch yesterday and see, in the end, we're not all that different.
It's Wednesday, September 20th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
There's so much going on in the world that sometimes I'm overwhelmed and I don't even know where to begin. I try to find the stories that will make a difference, that actually matter. And the only thing that really matters are those stories of people. I read a letter to the American people, and it was really a plea. But most people didn't read it, never heard it, didn't share it. I thought it was powerful. A story of a guy who could be just like you. When I stretched out my arms, I could touch the two opposite walls. The door was blocked with black garbage bags, leaving the room in total darkness. There was rotten, worm-infested food on the floor alongside scraps of clothing covered in feces. For a while, it felt as though I had been buried alive. It was a year before, while I was going to speak at a news conference, I was going to share my political thoughts when I was interrupted by 10 or 15 undercover secret police vehicles. A couple dozen armed agents came in and they tied my hands and covered my head with a black cloth. I was then locked in a cell without light or any kind of ventilation. I was denied any communication with the outside world, and I could speak with my lawyers only when I was taken to court. This went on for 10 days, and after then I was transferred to an administrative office inside the jail. It was there for the next 7 months. I slept on a mat on the floor. 3 months ago, the prosecutor in my case closed the investigation. He established that I wasn't guilty of any crimes. I had faced a trumped-up charge of possession of explosives. This meant that there are no active judicial proceedings against me. I'm just simply being held hostage in violation of the Constitution. Political imprisonment has been the punishment for daring to dream of a democratic society free of communism and open to the global community. We just want what so many other people around the world take for granted. Free elections, good governance, free expression, judicial independence, personal security, and a modicum of economic liberty. But an armed minority has managed to impose a regime of fear and corruption and blood. My case is evidence of that. I know I'm here for a just cause. My sacrifice and that of others like me will change millions of lives. Today, 93% of citizens in my country can't afford food. Because of food shortages that are the fault of our corrupt and brutal government, nearly three-quarters of our citizens say they have lost an average of about 17 pounds in the last few months. I don't want to think of a father's horror when his baby dies from a fever or something as simple as diarrhea that could have easily been treated if he just had access to simple medicine. I'm in prison, so this stops happening. That conviction gives me strength. My generation has made freedom its goal. I want to ask the people of the United States and the world to please stand by our side. I have finally been moved to a cell with a bed, though one with no windows. I can see the sun only an hour per week. I'm 32, and I've been a Democratic activist for 12 years. I have two children, 8 and 5, who are my sun and moon. I have a wife who I love and who now has to carry the burden of being married to a political prisoner. I write to you from my cell in the dungeons of the Venezuelan secret police. I will do everything in my power to keep resisting in prison. I'll keep dreaming of going home to sleep in a clean bed surrounded by my family. I'll keep dreaming of the day in which we all take to the streets to celebrate our freedom. These are the words of Jan Goikoetxe. He wrote these words from his prison cell in Caracas, Venezuela, a vivid reminder that freedom is costly. And we are foolish when we take it for granted. Today, as we get busy and think about other things, I would ask that you would pray for Jan and his family. Pray for the good people of Venezuela, because they're just ahead of us. They need a miracle, the same miracle that in the end will save us all.
A letter comes from a real political prisoner in Venezuela. It was published as an op-ed in the New York Times. We're going to post it at glenbeck.com here. We'll also tweet it from @worldofstew if you want to read it. Donald Trump gave a great speech yesterday at the United Nations. Maybe the best part of that being that his commentary on Venezuela, talking about how it's not about how socialism was implemented incorrectly. It was that it was implemented faithfully. That's the problem that's gone on there. So we're going to have more on that coming up.
So let me take you to Colorado Springs, Colorado. You know, as the world is suffering with earthquakes, while parts of our own country are bracing for the effects of yet another hurricane, while Puerto Rico is under siege today, Venezuela, people have political prisoners. What is it that so many of our citizens, I mean, we are grotesque. We're really grotesque on the things that we are complaining about and the things that we are doing because I have a right. Let me take you to Colorado Springs. The Budd family. The Budd family has been spending the last couple of weeks trying to find somebody in their neighborhood that they have dubbed the Mad Pooper. Kathy Budd says her kids first caught sight of this woman. She appears to be in her mid-30s, maybe 20s, 30s. She is athletically built. They have a picture of her from behind as she was running away. She's a jogger. And she is running and jogging around the neighborhood, and the Bud children look out the front window and scream, "Mom!" And here was this woman, mid-squat, pants down, unashamed, and the kids say, "Mom, there's a lady taking a poop in our front yard." "Come on, no they're not, no they're not, Mom!" And Mom comes and says, "Oh my," she opens up the door and she says, "Hey, what are you do? What are you doing?" She says, "Oh, sorry," pulls her pants up and runs away.
Oh, how else are you going to respond to that question?
Right. Okay. This was the first time that somebody had caught her doing it. She has been doing this now for the last 7 weeks. They don't know if she has just moved into the neighborhood. They don't know
is that a
who
pun?
She is. Yeah. Yesterday, they caught her yesterday again. She changed up her routine a little bit because she knew she was being watched. There are public restrooms, you know, it's Colorado Springs. They're public restrooms right there. CVS has caught her out in their front, you know, the median there, just taking a crap.
So it's something she enjoys.
Apparently.
You don't think apparently. It's a, you know, like a lot of people enjoy different things, you know, different folks.
No. So the Bud family has put a sign up in the yard that says, "Please, I'm begging you, please stop."
Please stop what?
Pooping in our front yard like a dog.
I think the sign needs to be more specific.
Yeah.
It needs to say, "Please stop pooping, all humans."
So do you really?
No human poop
really,
in this particular grassy area.
Do you really
area.
Need to say that?
I
see, this is the problem. This is the problem. In Venezuela, I am not kidding you, they are starving. And people are going out, families are going out at night, and they are hunting dogs and cats so they have something to eat. And what are we doing? We're having to chase people from crapping in our front lawn.
I used to go for a walk. We used to walk our dogs in this neighborhood, and it's a nice little suburban neighborhood where we used to live. Mm-hmm. And this one house, because a lot of people would walk their dogs past this house, and obviously that would become a problem. I guess dogs, not humans, but dogs would poop on this particular lawn. So they decided to put up a sign, and the sign said, it was a circle with the cross through it, the slash through it, and it had a picture of a dog taking a poop.
Yes.
So now, instead of occasionally having a piece of poop in their front yard, they have a picture of a dog pooping in their front yard all the time. This does not seem like you've solved the issue.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm expecting a little dog poop, and I'm expecting to catch a dog once in a while pooping in my front yard, which I don't want. And if you're doing that and you're walking your dog, please pick up the poop. Here was a quote from, I think it was a guy at CVS. He said, "I saw her." Now listen, listen to this. "I saw her, and honestly, I thought she was going to pick it up after and put it in a bag, but she didn't." That's the problem here? That's where you're starting with, "and she didn't pick it up." No, she pulled her pants down and took a crap in the middle of the street, man. You know, I know there are people, and we have to get into this later today. There are people that believe that September 23rd may be the day of the rapture. I'd like to remind you that no man knows, but And I'm not all down with the rapture thing, unfortunately. Gosh, I hope I'm not wrong on that. And then I'm left here and I'm like, oh, crap. Anyway, the September 23rd, people are saying, this is it. This is the signs in the heavens and everything. This is the end. I don't think it is, but I will tell you this. I'm going to look for the sign of people pooping in your front yard as, maybe men's hearts fail them. Maybe, women's sphincter muscles fail them and they just have to do that. I'm not sure. But I will tell you this, with the earthquake and the hurricanes, if you haven't gotten the idea that your life could change in a heartbeat and it's wise to be prepared so you can just stop worrying about things. I don't know what it's going to take to get this message. You can't prepare for everything, but there are a few things that you can do when it comes to a crisis. There's one thing that cuts across all of it, and that is you're going to need to have food, whether it's for you or somebody else, maybe somebody in your neighborhood, somebody in your town, somebody in your state. Actually having an emergency food supply is a lifesaver. Ask our friends in Houston and in Florida. Ask people in Mexico. Boy, there's no food on the shelves in Mexico for probably a couple of days at least. My Patriot Supply has food storage for you. Get their 70-serving survival food kit for only $67. Healthy food that lasts up to 25 years. For less than a dollar per serving, you'll get breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You were in Puerto Rico today. I can guarantee you, you're not running to the store. There's nothing on the shelves today. Call 800-977-0542 or order online at preparewithglenn.com. A prepared America is a strong America, and that's my Patriot Supply's mission. 1-800-977-0542 or preparewithglenn.com.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
Category 4, Maria is hitting Puerto Rico. This is the sound of it right now. Donald Trump has just declared Puerto Rico a disaster area, and they are now saying that Puerto Rico may be uninhabitable for weeks, if not months, after this. I mean, holy cow. I mean, I can see why people are saying September 23rd is, as I pointed out yesterday, so the book of Revelation is not going to be as scary as if these are the signs. I mean, yeah, it's bad, but it's not what I thought the book of Revelation's bad would be, right? So right. I mean, it's kind of like if people have disappeared on Saturday on the 23rd in the rapture, you'd be like, okay, well, I mean, maybe the rest of it's not going to be as bad. Maybe it's just been hyped. Maybe it's like one of those movies that everybody said, oh no, it's the greatest, and you went there and you're like, you wrecked it because it was good, but you built it up too far.
I believe yesterday on the show though, you said, well, the only thing we're missing is earthquakes. And then, I think you should shut up, yeah. Is what I think.
We're missing? Chocolate cake.
Ooh, there we go.
Let's see if that shows up.
Maybe it'll just appear.
The Mexican earthquake is just, have you ever been in Mexico City?
I have not.
I was just there 4 or 5 weeks ago. It is truly one of the greatest cities, I think, in the world. It is a beautiful city. Huge. I don't even know how many millions of people, 25 million people. It's up in the mountains. It's just not what you think of. When you think of Mexico, you're just like, I don't know, it's the beach or whatever. It's up in the mountains. It's cool. It's beautiful. And clean, uber clean. The parks and the streets and everything are just so clean.
That is surprising to hear. That was not my impression. 8.85 million in the actual city, in the greater area, 21.3 million. I mean, and they're talking
a giant city.
They're like, oh, well, there's a couple hundred people are dead, and we expect that number to rise. Yeah, it's going to rise a lot.
Do you remember? I don't know if you're old enough to remember 1985. Do you remember? Because that was the anniversary of that Mexico City earthquake that killed 10,000 people. The anniversary was yesterday. And this is the second earthquake. What was it? 500 miles away? Or
yeah, there's an 8.1.
Yeah.
Right? And then this was a 7.1?
Yes.
So really devastating. And, you know, like, no cities can handle stuff like this. You know, the further you get into the poorer areas, the worse it gets. And we're going to see that with the hurricane now, too.
Glenn Beck. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
With everything going on in the world, there are a few things that will actually change your life that we should pay attention to. And one of them is the Graham Cassidy bill. This is the Republicans, what some are saying, the last shot of getting anything done on a repeal and replace Obamacare. It is starting to shape up, and it looks like it has a chance of passage. First, let's explain what it is.
So let me give you a couple headlines. Reason.com, libertarian angle. Obamacare repeal is dead. Here come the bailouts. Now, Vox from the left says, I've covered the GOP repeal plan since day one. Graham Cassidy is the most radical. Don't you push me into Lindsey Graham's arms. Don't do it. So what does this thing actually do? It's basically, if you want to get a real quick summary, it's basically a federalist version of Obamacare. It is not a repeal of Obamacare. It is a federalist version of Obamacare.
Which means a state version of Obamacare, which is exactly what we were arguing for. If Massachusetts wants to do Obamacare, they could do it. If Texas says, no, there's a better way, let Texas do it. So that would have been okay back then, but that's not what this is now.
No, because all the money is still coming in. So the federal, all the money from Obamacare, largely, still goes to the federal government. And then it is distributed through block grants to the states to do what they want with. So you would have a situation where your conservative state would probably do a much better job with this, if you're a conservative, where a liberal state can do all the liberal things that they want. And what they're doing is they're taking the states, that all the money that's going to the states now, and dividing it up, what I would argue is more equitably. Like right now, if you have $100 in Obamacare money, that's split up between California and Texas. Right now, it's, let's say, $75 go to California, $25 go to Texas. What they're going to do is split that up and make it 50-50. That's a really generic way of explaining what it is.
For a really bad idea, I'm okay.
Yeah, it's again, I think this is another situation where it's better than Obamacare.
Yes.
But it's still Obamacare.
Yeah, it's still
bad. You will be able to get rid of the individual mandate. However, states could pass that on their own.
I don't have a problem. If state wants to do it, the state can do whatever it wants.
I personally think it's unconstitutional, as I know you do, at least from the federal side. But right, you're right. It's much better the smaller government you get to.
Yes.
Now, the reason why this is in such a rush is because the Republicans have 10 days to do this. The reconciliation process, which basically means you only have to get 51 votes instead of 60, that expires on September 30th by rule, because you can only do it once per fiscal year. So they have to get it done by September 30th, which means that the House won't be able to change it. There will be no negotiation between them.
Oh, what a surprise.
Yeah. It's kind of
convenient.
So if this happens, they were going to use reconciliation in 2018 for the tax bill. That's why they need to get this done in the next 10 days. And that's why it's such a panic. So how does the vote look? 41 pretty much on board for sure. They've all 41 senators have voted for all the Republican Obamacare repeals. So you're at 41. There are Heller and Graham. Graham is one of the co-sponsors. Heller has said he's on board on this as well. That gets you to 41. There are five that are likely to vote yes. Lamar Alexander, Shelley Moore Capito, Bob Corker, Tom Cotton, and Rob Portman, which all have very similar names. That puts you at 46 senators. You probably are definitely not going to get Susan Collins. Okay. You're probably definitely not going to get Lisa Murkowski, though that's not determined yet. You need to get all four of these in this scenario, which would be Mike Lee, who has not said anything about it yet. Jerry Moran, who is probably a yes, although he's complained about the Medicaid cuts, which aren't really cuts, but it's a whole other story. John McCain, who has voted against these things. However, his buddy, Lindsey Graham, is the guy behind this one, so I am so far counting him.
Lindsey stinking Graham is the author of this.
And then Rand Paul, who has said flat out he's a no on it,
But will, if he's the determining vote between this thing passing and not, will he hang with that? My guess is probably he will. I think there's a small chance of this passing. There's a better chance of this passing than what we remember them doing with skinny repeal. Remember that whole thing? Because that would have had, they've had to negotiate between the House and the Senate, and it never would have gone anywhere. There's a chance here.
What's the worst thing in it?
Well, there's a lot of bad things in it. First of all the Obamacare money stays. Obamacare in California could actually go further to the left. If you're someone who lives in a liberal state, you could actually get hit to the left and go further left of Obamacare. There are people who are arguing that this actually paves the way
for single payer
because what can happen here...
Some say it's a Trojan horse, but it's right
it's
there.
Right there. So a state like California could take this money and institute single payer. They'd have to obviously add some more tax dollars on their side to pay for it, but they could get the federal government to pay for, let's say, three quarters of single payer. So they pay, they make single payer in California, and they just go for it and go all
See,
out.
I have to tell you,
if 10 states do that, you've paved the way.
I have to tell you, as long as, and this isn't the world we live in, I don't care if California goes completely flat broke, as long as we make it very clear, we're not bailing your ass out.
Right. And you know that's,
and
not,
you know that's not the truth. Mm-hmm. But that would be fine. Look, if you want to try something, try it. If you can make it work, if we could find a single payer system that actually worked, which I don't think is possible.
No.
But if it would actually work, I'd be for it. It doesn't work. Now, if you can do an experiment in your state and you're not going to drag me down with you, go for it. But I'm not in on your experiment. It doesn't work.
Yeah, of course, that's how it winds up going every time. You wind up bailing them out anyway, and that's the risk here. We're going to see that with pensions, which is another thing we should get to at some point. But
yes,
this is one more thing on this. The DACA deal with Chuck Schumer. Remember this?
Yes.
They talked about this, and you know they've denied, well, there's not really a deal. But that whole deal, one of the big arguments for it from Donald Trump's side was to say that you're going to get help now from Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi when it comes to legislation like tax reform or Obamacare.
Yeah,
right. Like
right.
Maybe they'll work with you a little
sure.
bit. Listen to this quote from Chuck Schumer when Graham Cassidy comes out, a proposal that the president strongly supports. After a few weeks of lying dormant, Trump care is back and it's meaner than ever. While its latest version of Trump Care may live under a new name, no matter how many ways Republicans try to dress it up, this bill is even more dangerous than its predecessors. Even after dealing with this guy, he not only came out strongly against the proposal, which you can understand, he shouldn't change his principles, right? He personalized it to Trump. He took one of Trump's old quotes, calling it mean, to vilify him even further, and called it even more dangerous than all of the predecessors. Never deal with these people. They never, ever, ever will honor what they've said.
...17-year-old kid and his girlfriend of 8 months have made the news for something that I think that all of us have gone through, and I'm puzzled by this story. So, Destiny and her boyfriend, Kit Acone, live here in Dallas, and if they were friends, and then they started dating, and she had texted him saying that she was hungry, and he said, I'll pick you up later and we'll grab a bite together. So he picks her up and right after school, and he says, you hungry? And she said, oh, I just I'd kill for a burger. Now, he had this sinking feeling that I think all of us have had. Any guy has had this, where you only have a certain amount of cash and you don't want to look like you have no money, but you have no money. And so he says, he knows that she likes this burger at Chili's. And so they go to Chili's, they sit down, and, the waiter takes the order. She orders this burger, and he says, no, I've already eaten. I'm good. And she's like, no, come on. I can't eat by myself. He's like, no. I'm good. You eat. You're hungry. So she eats. She offers him a bite all the way through. Please have some. Please just share. He's like, no, I'm stuffed. Well, the truth is he wasn't stuffed. He just didn't have enough money for him to eat. And he wanted her to eat. And he would eat, you know, at home with his box of macaroni and cheese or whatever he chose, because that's what I used to choose because they were 23 cents a box. This is something that we have, I think, every guy has done. Did you do that with Lisa?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. And if you're going to spend 23 cents, it should be on powdered cheese. That's actually
exactly
a principle,
right?
I live by.
You know, if you spend $23, it might as well be on powdered cheese. But anyway, so here's why this is in the news. They've been dating now for 8 months, and I don't know, he tweets her, Facebooks her, and says, you know, that first date, I was actually starving. And she's like, why didn't you tell me? We could have just gone to the store and just grabbed something cheap and I would have made sandwiches. And he said, no, I wanted you to eat. I wanted you to have something good. Now, this is something that I think every guy has done on a date. Mm-hmm. Every parent has even done this with your children. Your children are out and you're doing something, or you are making food at home and you're giving them the best, and you're like, nope, I'm not hungry. I don't need it. You need it.
We don't look like we skip meals, but we do.
Right. Yes. This is a story today on BuzzFeed. And my question is, has chivalry died to the point to where this is something that people are reading going, wow, look at that guy.
It's so notable.
Right.
That now BuzzFeed's actually writing national news stories about it.
Is that possible? Is it possible that we live in such a place now that the majority of the people, at least writing, have never been in that position themselves? I'm trying to figure why this is a story. Because this is the way America has always been. This is the way men have always been. This is what you're supposed to do. This is not a news story. I don't know if you have checked to find your name at Equifax to see that breach that they had at Equifax, if that has affected you. 143 million Americans are affected by it. The organization that determined credit card numbers and to see if your credit was good, if they were watching over your credit, they had a hack. 143 million Americans, 200,000 consumers with their personal data, the Social Security number, and their credit card number was accessed. So once it's out, first of all, if all of that information was stolen for 143 million Americans, that's half of us, that information was stolen, it's out, and there's no putting that genie back in the bottle. If you haven't been hacked yet, if your identity hasn't been taken yet, it will. It's only a matter of time. Somebody's identity is stolen every 2 seconds. And here's the difference. LifeLock will go through and look at a wide range of identity threats. They don't just look at your credit score like Equifax. They actually look at everything. And if there is a problem, there's somebody here in the U.S., a U.S.-based identity restoration specialist that's going to work to fix it. Now, as we can see, nobody can prevent all identity theft, monitor all transactions at all businesses. It's not possible. But LifeLock can see more of the threats than anyone else. They can see more of the threats to your identity, and they alert you, and they step in to help fix it right away. Go to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LIFELOCK. Use the promo code Beck. That's LifeLock.com, promo code Beck. Get 10% off your membership. LifeLock.com, promo code Beck.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
I don't know if if you even remember in September 26th, 1983, this is really at the height of the Cold War with the Soviets and the United States. And we were, you know, calling Moscow the evil empire. And I remember working in Washington, D.C. and thinking after they shut down the Soviets shut down the Korean airliner. I'm in the vaporization zone. I mean, we're going to be hit by a nuke. On September 26, 1983, Stanislav Petrov was sitting in his office and he received a message that told him that five nuclear missiles had been launched from the United States and were on their way, and they had about 20 minutes to launch a counterattack. Everything on his screen said, launch now. All he had to do was pick up the phone and say, launch. The sirens went off. He said, I sat there for a few minutes, staring at this big backlit red screen with the words launch on it. He said, everything I had showed me the United States was attacking us. If I would have picked up the phone, we would have launched. He said, we had been trained to obey, not to think. He said, but there was no rule saying how long we were allowed to think before we reported the strike. He said, I knew that every second that was passing was taking up valuable time. He said, but I couldn't move. He said, I felt like I was sitting on a hot frying pan and I just couldn't move. Luckily, it didn't feel right to him to launch, and he didn't. The world is probably vastly different because he waited. It was a bug in the system, and he thought, this is a new system. I bet there's something wrong here. And he didn't give the order to launch and save the world. The reason why I bring this story up is because he just passed away at 77.
Glenn Beck. Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
So something happened that was, I thought, terrifying during President Trump's speech at the UN yesterday. It wasn't anything he said. Rather, it was the reaction to what he said.
The problem in Venezuela is not that socialism has been poorly implemented, but that socialism has been faithfully implemented.
So he waited for a second. But they just stared at him. It was like he was speaking an alien language. Yesterday, he was waiting for the assembly to stand up or to applaud at that line, but it was so quiet you could have heard a pin drop. And this is what's scary. 75% of the UN probably believes wholeheartedly that socialism is the answer. But when a state makes the decision in everything in your life, it's never good. Venezuela was supposed to be the crown jewel. It's the progressive paradise. Everyone in Hollywood praised Venezuela. Sean Penn, Oliver Stone, Naomi Campbell, Michael Moore, Bernie Sanders, all of them. In fact, on Bernie Sanders' own website, he claims that if the American dream would be more apt to be realized in Venezuela than in the United States. So why is it everybody loves Venezuela? I think probably because it was a country that had so much promise. And then when they went and started to really fully embrace socialism entirely, none of us ever lived there. What does the utopia actually look like? Inflation nears now 800%. Basic goods like toilet paper are severely rationed. The nation with the largest oil reserves in the world has to import oil and has oil and gasoline shortages. What's really so heartbreaking, the people are struggling for food every single day. At night, many citizens go on the prowl to hunt for rats, cats, or dogs. This is what progressives across the world call a paradise. Misery is the politics. Ask Bernie Sanders. The lack of food is, believe it or not, a sign of success.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes American journalists talk about how bad a country is because people are lining up for food. That's a good thing. In other countries, people don't line up for food. The rich get the food and the poor starve to death.
Ask a Venezuelan what it's like to deal with food rationing. What is it like to stand in line for food, to get turned away, and then have to go dig through the trash in a last-ditch effort to feed your family? Ask them what it's like to watch their leaders rip up the Constitution and seize even more power and more control. Power and control. Power and control. In the end, I don't care if it's the Nazis or the communists. I don't care if it's the left or the right. There is another way. Individual freedom. Power and control, in the end, that is what the progressive, socialist, left and right agenda is always all about.
It's Wednesday, September 20th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
We're changing as a people, and I just want to drop a pin in the map. And I just want to say we're going over a cliff. And as I learned from one of the righteous among the nations in Poland a few years ago, and I've shared many times, the righteous didn't suddenly become righteous. They just refused to go over the cliff with everyone else. Don't go over the cliff. There's a new survey out, and we'll talk about it later, about how so many college students are now saying freedom of speech is not that important. It is. Societies can go crazy quickly. In 1923, there was a survey of parents of disabled children. Would you agree definitely to a painless shortcut of your child's life after it's determined by experts that it is incurably stupid? The results of this survey, this study, were published in 1925. 73% of those adults who had children said they were willing to have their children killed if they weren't told about it. Well, what do you think happened in Germany after these kinds of polls started to come out? And we're headed down the same road.
The stat comes from an amazing op-ed in the New York Times called "The Nazis' First Victims Were Disabled." It comes from Kenny Fries. He's the author of not only that op-ed, but also the book "In the Province of the Gods." And he joins us live from Germany.
So, Kenny, first of all, you were born without bones in your legs?
Yep. I was born in 1960, missing fibula in my legs. And spent the first 4 weeks of my life in an incubator. People didn't know whether I would be able to walk. Some thought I shouldn't be, you know, allowed to live, but luckily my parents weren't amongst them. So, yeah, and then lived a pretty, you know, normal life. I was one of the first kids to be schooled in a mainstream school in Brooklyn, New York in the 1960s. And, you know, went to college, and after college I started to write about my disability experience, which then, you know, much later in 2002 brought me to Japan. I wanted to look at what another country, a culture very different from our own, looked at how they looked at disability. So I went to Japan, and the result was my new book, In the Province of the Gods. And I learned some interesting things there, Glenn. I mean, I was very surprised when I went to Japan that I was treated more as a foreigner, which I was, than I was as a disabled person. Whereas in my own country in the United States, I was always looked at as different because I was disabled. So I kind of felt like a foreigner in my own country. And I also found out a lot about how central, central disability was to Japanese culture at the historically, at the same time where it was looked at as something shameful. And you talk about, you know, what happened in Germany. There was a story that happened in Yokohama, Japan in the early 1970s, where a mother had a child with cerebral palsy, and she had numerous children. And in true Japanese fashion, you know, the husband was away a lot, and she was very overburdened by having the child, and she killed the child. And though she was charged with murder and found guilty, the outcry was so great that people felt so sorry for her that she really got off without any punishment for killing her own child.
Kenny, there was a story that came out in a couple of weeks ago, I think, about Reykjavik, how Reykjavik is becoming a country that will, and it was celebrated, this first city or country that now that will be Down syndrome free, because they're doing early testing and most people are aborting these children before they're born. So Reykjavik now is Down syndrome free birth. And I found that article really disturbing as a dad of a child of special needs. My daughter has cerebral palsy. I wouldn't wish this for my child. It's difficult. However, her life has real meaning and real purpose. And I don't understand. We're crossing some spooky lines.
Yep, we are. And we can't forget that, you know, and as I pointed out in my New York Times article, that the history in our own country, in the United States, is not free of these things. Back in 1927, in the Buck v. Bell decision, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes said three generations of imbeciles was enough, and it was constitutional to sterilize, disabled people. One thing in our own culture, we used to have what they call the ugly laws, where you were not prohibited from being in public if you were disabled, if you looked different, if you looked, you know, deformed. And the last of those laws wasn't rescinded until 1974, Glenn. So, you know, it's...
Because I've never heard of the ugly law. I mean, I know about the Human Betterment Society. I know all about the nastiness of what we've done with eugenics. I think we were, in some ways, we taught the Germans an awful lot. But when it comes to the ugly laws, was that one of those laws that just happened to still be on the books? Like, you know, you can't tie your horse up at the supermarket. And it just wasn't removed, or
they started being passed in the 1860s, 1870s in various cities across the country. Some states tried to pass them, and they weren't as successful as cities. So they were basically local ordinances
that
just basically said you can't. Yeah. There's also a case in Germany that happened a couple of decades ago called the Frankfurt Judgment, where people went on a holiday, you know, they booked a holiday, and they encountered disabled people on their holiday, and they asked to be reimbursed by their travel agent, because they happened upon these disabled people, and they won in court. So these feelings about disability are prevalent in a lot of cultures. I would say probably all cultures. So, they just manifest themselves differently.
So can we have an adult conversation here, Kenny? And this is not popular to do, and it will be taken, you know, and chopped up. But we have to have real conversations because we're dealing with really scary stuff. I as we're looking at healthcare, the argument is about we just can't let people die, et cetera, but when a state is in control, there's too many examples of it just comes down to the money. And if you can't opt out of that, you know, and the state says, hey, you're not producing enough potatoes, I got to give this money to somebody else who has a better quality of life and are going to actually put into the system. And it becomes this horror show versus, well, these people can't afford any health care, and so they're just going to die, which is also awful. I mean, how do you balance those two? In my mind, I would rather have the chance to opt out or opt in than being stuck in a system where whatever they call and say, I'm sorry, you're done, you're done.
Well, I mean, you know, to go back to, you know, to Japan, I mean, you know, in Japan, I don't know if you know the movie Ballad of Narayama, where they basically take this small villages in Japan. A while back, they would take their elderly when they were old to just go to the mountain and to basically die alone in the mountain, which I don't think is a good thing to do either.
Oh, no, it's like Logan's Run, low tech.
Yeah, but the problem, Glenn, is that you, in a society that disvalues disability, that misunderstands disability, that fears disability, you can't make a true voluntary choice. If, you know, people say that if somebody, you know, when I get dementia, if I get Alzheimer's, I don't want to live like that. It's not a dignified life. But what are they reacting to? They're reacting to a fear about the body changing. And if the disability experience teaches anything, it says it is about the fact that that's what our life is. Our life is change. You know, I talk about this in the province of the gods, because Japan deals with the idea of change, which ultimate change is mortality, that we're all, you know, not going to be here after a while. So it's this fear that I think gets in the way of making a decision of what one would want to do if one was, you know, severely disabled, you know, Alzheimer's, whatever it is. And I don't think you can make a rational choice in a society that disvalues disability and disabled lives.
So, Kenny,
so what is dignity? The only dignity you could have is to die. I mean, is that dignified? I don't think that's dignified.
This what you're saying, Kenny, is going counterculture. I mean, I agree with you, but it's really going counterculture now. And I, as a libertarian, I don't want to tell you what you have to do. But we are going into a culture that is wanting to make the decisions for people and based on quality of life. I don't know where to, how do we change this? How do we restart this human spark?
We look at why we're afraid of difference, and why in this particular case, why are we afraid of disability? Why are we afraid of mortality?
So why are we? Do you have a thought on it? Why are we?
Well, I have lots of thoughts on it. I think we're afraid because we're all afraid of death. For example, I was once on book tour with an anthology called Staring Back that I edited, and a very, very wonderful writer named Susan Nussbaum, who lives in Chicago, was sitting at breakfast, minding her own business. And a woman just came over to her and said, I'm so glad you're here. And Susan looked at her and said, like, what? I'm eating breakfast. What do you mean I'm so glad I'm here? And the woman said to her, I'm so glad I'm not you.
Oh, my gosh.
Susan had a disability. Yeah. And this woman had the need to go over and actually say that to Susan. It wasn't like, you know, she was in conversation with her. Susan was just minding her own business. And I think that that's, you know, it's the, what's the, I'm Jewish, I'm not Christian, so what if I miss up the phrase, there for the grace of God go I?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you look, I mean, throughout history, disability has been looked at through the religious moral model, where the disabled person is looked at as either very, all totally good, a saint, or evil, a devil. And then we move to the medical model, where the only way to deal with disability is to basically kill it or cure it. When, if you really look at it, the only way, disability is really defined by the society that you're in, by the barriers that are put in your way. It's really the society that disables people, not the impairment itself in most cases. I mean, if you ask anybody you know, what's more difficult, being disabled or dealing with the barriers put in your way? They're going to say it's the barriers. So, I mean, that's, you know,
Kenny,
that's the dilemma we're in.
I hope that we get a chance to speak again. I thank you so much for your time, but I'd love to have you in and to have this continuing conversation with you. It's one I think we desperately need as a society. Thanks.
It's not just history, too. If you look at the op-ed from Kenny Fries, he quotes Peter Singer, the chair of ethics at Princeton, saying this: in 2015, I don't want my health insurance premiums to be higher so that infants who can experience zero quality of life have expensive treatments. Amazing. His book, by the way, At World of Stew, you can get the link to the book and his op-ed of the New York Times.
Liberty Safe is not only making great safes, but they make it easy to own one. Now at LibertySafe.com, you can buy a Liberty Safe at a great price and receive 12 months interest-free payments with zero down and zero APR. They even offer a Liberty Safe for as low as $20 a month. I've been working with Liberty now for 7 years, and I have not seen them do deals like this. And I will tell you, there's nothing like the peace of mind that you get when you have a Liberty Safe. Do what I did. Had your safe installed right now in your home with 12 payments interest-free, 12 months of payments interest-free, and as low as $20 a month on proved credit. So go there now. It's Liberty Safe. They're the home of the best-built safes on the planet. It's LibertySafe.com.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
You know, I just have to tell you, I'm so deeply offended, what a surprise, by something that Keith Ellison said about DACA. Listen to this.
So this is not someone else's fight. This is all of our fight. But some people are in the bullseye and others of us are not exactly the target. Therefore, it is our responsibility to stand up, fight, and do the right thing. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm one of the people who believes we should give our neighbors sanctuary. And if you ask yourself, what would I do if I was a Gentile in 1941, if my Jewish neighbors were under attack by the Nazis? Would I give them sanctuary? You might be about to find out what you would do. Will you pass that moral test, or will you fail it?
So I just want to show you that Keith Ellison has compared our government, our workers, our president, and everyone else directly to the Nazis. And beyond that, he has said that those who came here illegally, who we're not putting in gas chambers, we want to send them back home, are akin to the Jews that died in gas chambers.
Glenn Beck. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Thank you so much for listening today. We have a lot going on. There is a hurricane that is now wiping off the face of the earth. They say that it's going to be uninhabitable for weeks, if not months. Puerto Rico, we'll give you the update on that. We had an earthquake yesterday in Mexico City. We'll give you details on how you can help. And wars, rumors of wars. September 23rd, there's a lot of people that believe that this is talked about in the book of Revelation. If we have a chance to talk about that, just so you can pack your bags or not, because September 23rd is Saturday. And there are a lot of people that are believing, I'm not one of them, but there are a lot of people believing that that is in the book of Revelation, and this is the day of rapture.
What a great day to subscribe to the Blaze, because you're probably not going to have to make the payment
right
for the second month.
You get all of it for free, yeah. And then you're gone.
Yeah, because you can get. I think there's some sort of intro period.
We're like, where's this deadbeat that promised us the $9.99 a month? He just left his clothes there on his desk in his chair in his office. All right, so we have that coming up in a minute.
So the podcast, How I Built This. Is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And it just, they do interviews with all these people who started these amazing businesses and how they did it. Mm-hmm. And the stories are really interesting if you love how these things happen. There's one interesting one lately with Jen Hyman. She's the founder of Rent the Runway.
Did you rent the runway, Glenn?
I have three daughters and a
so
wife.
You are.
I'm very well aware of Rent the Runway,
so,
which I think is actually brilliant.
It's a brilliant idea.
Brilliant idea.
Exactly. That's an interest. It's interesting that you use that because we're going to come back to that. The wording you just used there. This is Jen Hyman talking about how she was coming up and very early on how she was developing the idea for this business. Listen.
I had this thesis that we had entered the experience economy. And people were getting married later and starting to value experiences like travel over owning things. And so I had an idea at the time to launch the first honeymoon registry in the world, where couples could register for their honeymoons and their friends and family could contribute by, you know, paying for scuba diving or paying for a massage or a hotel night, as opposed to buying them pots and pans. So as a 22-year-old, I was really passionate about this idea. I emailed the president of Starwood, and I pitched him on this idea to start a wedding business.
Now, again, that's a brilliant thought, right?
It
she's
is.
22 years old,
yeah.
And she's thinking of the world that
yes,
way.
Love it.
Really smart. Now she comes up with Rent the Runway, which if you don't know, she's going to explain kind of what it is here.
It is brilliant.
It is a brilliant idea. And it also says, and the way she explains this says something so profound about where we are as a society. Listen.
As her responsible older sister, I was remarking how she should probably wear one of the dresses in her closet again, as opposed to being in credit card debt. And her response to me was, you know, everything in my closet is dead to me. I've been photographed in it. The photographs are up on Facebook, and I need something new.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, Becky was a 25-year-old, like, normal girl who lived in New York. She wasn't a celebrity, but she was talking about being photographed and not being able to wear something again.
Wow.
And it was a light bulb moment for me because I realized I was having a conversation with my sister about the experience of wearing an amazing dress, of walking into a party, feeling self-confident and feeling beautiful. And that's what she cared about. And she didn't care about the actual ownership of the items in her closet. The other thing she cared about was the photograph that would exist after the party that she could post on Facebook and kind of share with everyone she knew how awesome she felt and how confident she felt at that wedding.
I mean,
okay, so she is. So here's another reason. This is why she's successful. If my sister would have said that to me, I wouldn't have thought of a business idea.
No.
I would have thought, what the hell is wrong with you?
Right, exactly. Right? What is wrong with you?
I would have gone into, well, we're going into an experience economy. I would have gone to, we are doomed as a people.
Exactly. That's why she's a success, right?
Right. She's finding a way. As we're going to hell, she's like, wait, we can make money on this.
Yeah. It's exactly.
Right.
So she, again, you use the word brilliant. I think that's completely applicable here. These are genius thoughts. If I could ever think like this in these moments.
Rent the Runway is truly brilliant.
And if you don't know the business model, essentially she solved the problem her sister had by you're able to now rent these ridiculously expensive dresses for one night and then you send them back.
Right.
They'll send them to you. They send you in two different sizes. So you can make sure the one fits perfectly. Then you send both of them back. You have the night with the glamorous thing that, you know, Jennifer Aniston's
wearing.
And
they're literally, you know, they can be up to like $5,000 dresses.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all the best designers.
Right. And you're renting them instead of buying it once and then never, ever wearing it again.
Yeah.
And so stupid.
It's an amazing, it's a great idea, right? Also, to show you how successful they are now the largest dry cleaner in America.
Oh my gosh.
That's how successful this business is. But she goes into a conversation later on about sexual harassment and sexual discrimination against women. She's a female business owner. Obviously, this is something that's going to come up, right? In an interview. And it was really interesting.
Is it?
I think it is, right? Well,
in
today's day and age, I think it wouldn't be in mine either.
Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, that's where
this interview
went. And she talked about one incident, which was really legitimate standard what you'd think about when you thought of sexual harassment towards women. And she had a real concrete example of that. But she went further than that one and talked about a more subtle form of it. And I thought this was a really interesting lesson about business today and how difficult it's got to be to navigate. Listen.
The second form of sexual harassment / gender discrimination is way more subtle, and it's way more difficult to prove. But for instance, overall, I have seen male founders receive, you know, sometimes more mentorship or more chances to be successful. They get more strikes against them before their investors kind of pull the plugs. And in a lot of cases, women are only given, you know, it's a one striker, you're out as the CEO and founder.
So hang on, may I just say, do you hear conservatives bitching about that? Because that's a conservative's life. I can't tell you how I was introduced to people, you know, even just this last weekend, compared to how what the options were for everyone else. Because I was a conservative in a room full of liberals, because I think differently, not because of my gender. This happens, and you can either let it crush you or you can get up off your ass and move on.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, I thought it was an interesting thing of less opportunity at mentorship. Just think about that for a second. She's saying that, like, you know, a male is going to look at another male and relate to them and sure. bring them along and give them opportunities. Now, she tries to illustrate what she means by these subtle forms of a sexual harassment. Listen.
There was a time early in my career where an investment firm, you know, said to me, oh, Jen, you know, you should really meet these other entrepreneurs. They're around your own age. They're brilliant. You could learn a lot from them. They're building incredible companies. They're going to change the world. Now, all of those entrepreneurs were men, and they were kind of prefaced as being geniuses, brilliant, etc. And this same firm never introduced me in that same way to those yeah. same entrepreneurs, even though we were at similar tenure and similar stages in our company. The irony is a lot of those guys, their businesses, you know, aren't around anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm the one who's still chugging.
Wait, is that sexual discrimination, or is that you're used to something? I'm working with somebody day to day, and I say, oh my gosh, you have to meet all of these brilliant people that I know over here. I mean, I'm working with you. Is that discrimination, or is that just I'm just used to you and I want to introduce you to these brilliant people that will help you? And I'm sorry I didn't go out and say I have this really brilliant... I'm trying to help you.
Yeah. I mean, another way of describing a business person saying to one up-and-coming business person, hey, here's a bunch of geniuses you should talk to, is mentorship. The thing she's saying she doesn't get, and it's a subtle form of sexual harassment, is what that business owner was trying to do. He was trying to mentor her and bring her into a group of other smart people. And what he gets for that is later on, years later, in an interview, his efforts are described as sexual harassment. And you wonder why, partially, women might get fewer opportunities is because male business owners are terrified of what just happened there.
You know what? It's not just that. It's not just women. It's across the spectrum. And it's why we don't talk to each other. And quite honestly, I think, you know, the hierarchy of needs, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's been turned upside down, but there's a different way to look at it. That there's another triangle that America has invented and that is sitting on top of that triangle. And I'm going to share that on tomorrow's broadcast. When it comes to your mortgage, buying or refinancing, you need people that take away the stress in your life and not add any more. That's why there's American Financing. The salary-based mortgage consultants at American Financing are dedicated to making sure that you make a smart mortgage decision that aligns with your goals and your finances. Banks are selling you something. They're trying to get you to buy something. You know, you go into a car dealership, you know that they're motivated to sell that car because they win. American Financing is not motivated to sell you a certain car or a certain mortgage. They have no skin in that game. The skin in the game is that you're doing business with them and they're going to find the right one because they know if they treat you right this time and get you the right mortgage the next time or the time you want to refinance or the next time you want to buy a house, or the next time a friend says buy a house, if they treat you right and give you the best deal, that's how they win. American Financing is now doing reverse mortgages, which are a good way to increase your monthly cash flow with no mortgage payment while still retaining ownership for your home, but you need the information on it and find out if it's right for you. I want you to call their number, 800-906-2440. That's 1-800-906-2440, or online at AmericanFinancing.net.
American Financing Corporation, NMLS 182334, www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
Jonathan Dunn, who is over in Ireland and a listener of this program, and has been kind of writing and doing some podcasts with us over the years, happens to be visiting here in the United States and giving some speeches and talks around the United States, happens to be in our studio today. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
How you doing, sir? How are you?
I'm good. So, first of all, you have tried to come over and work in the United States, and which country doesn't want you? Is it us, or is it Ireland just doesn't want to let you go?
No, I don't meet the visa requirements to get over here. So I don't meet the educational or the work requirements to get a work visa to come over here to the great state of Texas in America, but it is what it is. So my dream is dead, but my service starts now.
Yeah, so here, your dream's not dead. It's just on hold. It's just on hold.
It feels dead.
Does it?
Yes.
You've wanted, because you were a weird kid, you've always loved the United States.
Yes.
And that's weird over there, mm-hmm. Is it not?
Oh, absolutely. So picture yourself as a 7 or 8 year old boy in Ireland, dull, boring weather, boring climate, just seeing the status quo. And then you get the transport and go over to Clearwater, Florida, warm weather, different climate, beautiful women, mm-hmm. great food, great sports.
Right.
I was in love from day one.
Right.
It's a love affair that hasn't ended.
And it's not just because of the beaches and everything else. You've actually become a fan of the founders.
Absolutely. So I fell in love with the country, and that's what started the love affair. But then as I learned more about your history, I've become absolutely fascinated with the idea of America. And it's an idea that the world needs to hear.
And you are... I sense this frustration in you in some way. That you have a friend in America that is beating itself up, and you're like, what the hell's wrong with you?
Well, it's beating itself up because you're listening to the media and the politicians tell you suck, and it's not the case. So as an Irishman, I have one thing in common with a famous Frenchman. I don't have many things in common with France, but I share the sentiment of Alexis de Tocqueville. America is great because Americans are good. And that's a slam on the rest of the world, because the difference about America compared to the world is there are many, you're the exact opposite. But one of the things is you're about the individual. So I tell people, when I think of Great Britain, I think of the Queen. When you think of Iran right now, you think of the Ayatollah. When you think of North Korea, you think of Kim Jong-un. When I think of America, I always think of your people. And your people have been over here watching and hearing the stories of Houston. Total devastation. Yet your people have stood up. Your people have sacrificed.
Do you think that the people of Ireland wouldn't have done that?
They would have done helped. They might have helped some points. But I've heard stories. I met a man, a wonderful gentleman, and he shared a story of how he hasn't had light and heat in his house for 2 weeks. So he hasn't got money. But yeah, he has money to put gasoline into drums to bring down to Houston. Irish people would help people if they had the money spare. But in Ireland and in Europe, if the choice is I eat or you eat, that's not an equation that you want to hear the answer to. America, time and time again, helps each other factually. You go look at who donates the most time and money. Factually, America is right there at the top. It's behind Miramar, which is not really, shouldn't even be counted. But time and time again, you shared a story earlier on about the dating.
Mm-hmm.
That's the culture. You choose to help other people. Your wonderful nation is so wonderful. Not because of a president, not because of a Congress, not even true to the Constitution. It's because of your people.
So let me return the favor. I read a book about Ireland this week, summer. It's How the Irish Saved the Western Civilization. Have you ever read that? It's fascinating.
Okay.
One of the things that I learned is about the truth on St. Patrick.
Okay.
And driving the snakes, which didn't happen.
We love our mitts and arms.
Before you go home tomorrow, maybe you can come back tomorrow. I want to ask you the question that I found out about St. Patrick. It is a completely different story, and the world needs to hear that story, not the one that we all go out and just drink our faces off for. Back in just a second.
Glenn Beck.
So if you're traveling for business a lot, you know that it's not fun. It's not necessarily a big joy. There's a lot of things that can happen. Sometimes people's bare feet come in between your seats and they're sitting on your armrest. I've seen pictures of it, people. It's terrible. Upside.com can make this a lot better. Look, you're going to have to do business travel. Why not, number one, save a bunch of money? Number two, get a free Amazon gift card when you book your travel that you can spend on whatever you want. For example, nose plugs, because there's bare feet on the armrest near you. Also, they have these upside navigators that go above and beyond for business travels. We're talking 6-star service. They are accessible anytime, 24/7 by voice, chat, email, or message on the Upside app. And they'll even reach out to you when they can help. And I start your 6-star treatment right now. Go to upside.com, use the code Beck, and you're going to get a $100 minimum gift card from amazon.com. That's code Beck for a $100 minimum gift card, upside.com. Upside.com, minimum purchase required. See site for complete details.
Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
What is the point of diversity? Seriously. I mean, diversity for diversity's sake is absolutely meaningless. For college campuses, the educational system here in America, let me rephrase that, America's educational industry, diversity is very meaningful. Apparently, diversity at American elite colleges, however, is in jeopardy. According to the New York Times, 15% of American 18-year-olds were black and 22% Hispanic in 2015. Yet college freshmen at elite colleges were only 6% black and 13% Hispanic. And those numbers were lower than they were in 1980. Now, this is a crisis for progressives. The New York Times say these colleges need to go above and beyond affirmative action and fix this problem. We need more than affirmative action. A Georgetown law professor says elite colleges will only reflect America's overall diversity when colleges blow up the system of admissions. They even propose that colleges stop using standardized test scores. I mean, we can't test people. Do you want these people graduating from colleges like this building airplanes that you're going to fly in? Because I don't. I like a standard. Can I see your test scores, please? We have to stop with the diversity hand-wringing. Affirmative action is inherently unfair, and perhaps it started with good intentions. But like most progressive ideas, it's imploded. How about an admission system that is simply merit-based? I don't care about the color of your skin. I don't care. I don't care what you call yourself. I don't care what gender you... I don't care if you think you're a space alien. What have you been doing? Show me your work. That's it. Is it too much to ask? Maybe it's also time to look at how much we're paying for an education. College is now insanely expensive. Insanely. Even though our elite colleges have endowments that are worth billions of dollars, all tax exempt, tuition is more expensive than ever and goes up about 41% in the last few years. Why? Because college is big business, and progressivism and affirmative action are all part of the game.
It's Wednesday, September 20th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
So how good do we have it here in America? Let me just have you answer this question. Have you ever been so destitute that you actually thought, I wonder how much they'd give me for my kidney?
I can guarantee you that it has been thought of in many places around the world, but not here in America. I mean, going to a loan shark with selling one of your organs on the black market for quick cash. How much are your organs worth? How much could you sell your eyes for if you were forced to sell them? How much could your family get for your heart? These organs are actually worth a lot more than you thought. A kidney can fetch $200,000 on the black market. By the way, 75% of all black market sales, kidneys. All-time bestseller, this kidney's got to go. Corneas, $24,400. The heart is only worth $119,000. Bone marrow, you can sell your bone marrow, $23,000 per gram. I mean, I don't know how much marrow is in there, but I might have it. $23,000 a gram, I might have some marrow I could spare from time to time. The reason why I bring this up is because, A, I mean, it's insane that there is a price list for organs. But there's also a problem with organ sales, and especially it's happening in the Middle East. We were going to announce something with Operation OUR this week, but because they are having some really dicey elections going on right now, and we have to see how the dust settles. They have a referendum going on. We have to see how the dust settles. We're putting that on pause for a little while, but we are ready to do something truly remarkable. Truly remarkable. But because of what I've been working on, I happen to know about the organ sales that are going on. Did you see the report yesterday, Stu, on the number of slaves that are out now?
Yeah, I mean, what is it, 40?
40.3 million.
40.3 million slaves, and that's more than the entire history of the old school slave trade that we think was so.
This weekend, I was up at the Nantucket Project, and I was talking about slavery. And I said, there are more slaves than the entire Western slave trade, the 400 years of Western slave trade alive today combined, all of them combined, 400 years. There's more people alive today in chains than that.
That's an incredible stat. And to back you on that, when you first said it, I was like, oh, geez, where did he get that? I mean, I didn't believe you. And so I went and looked it up, and it is actually legitimately a true statistic.
So and you're a stat boy, so I know you would have looked it up. But that's what my daughter said, which, because she was sitting in the crowd, and she said, nobody believed you on that stat, Dad.
I didn't believe it either.
Yeah. She said, you know, people are like, yeah, that can't be true. And it is true. And think of that. What are we doing right now? We are talking about pulling down statues because they were for slavery, and some of them were saying that the founders were bad because they were silent on slavery, even though most of them weren't. They were silent on slavery, and the argument is, wait a minute, you can't judge them 250 years ago. That slavery was a normal thing back then. So they had to be wildly forward thinking to be against it. Okay, how about today? We're all clearly against it, right? We all know slavery's wrong. Do you know how ISIS is now funding itself? Because we bombed the direct route of the oil trade. Do you know one of the main ways they are funding ISIS right now? The slave trade, and even worse, kidneys. They are kidnapping children. And they are cutting the kidneys and the hearts out of them, and they are selling them on the black market. Where are the abolitionists today? Seriously, where are the abolitionists today? This is the hardest thing. I watched a documentary last night, and I'm not recommending that you watch it. because it's called I Am Jane Doe, and it's really it's powerful. It is powerful, but it's all about the slave trade, and it's all about America today and how kids in America are being kidnapped and they are being used in the sex industry against their will. They are being drugged and beaten, and they're actually, believe it or not, the Village Voice was the main perpetrator of the sales for this, okay, called their Backpage.
Oh, they were placing ads for...
Yes, yeah. And that's still, it's still not taken care of. It's still not shut down. And it is, it's remarkable what is going on. And I thought to myself, I'm watching this, I'm thinking, nobody's watching this movie. Nobody is watching this movie because it's too horrific. And that is the problem that our founders had back 200 and some years ago when they were upset about it and they wanted to stop it. Benjamin Franklin was one of the biggest abolitionists, if not the biggest abolitionist of the founding era. And he couldn't get people to listen, because what happened? It's not affecting me. It can't be that bad of a problem, because most people didn't have slaves. It can't be that much of a problem. Well, they did something to deserve it. That's what we think. But what did they think? Well, they're not really people like us. Anything that'll keep you blind. And so how do you get that story out? And we are facing exactly the same issue on trying to get that story out as our founders did at the founding of our country. And the same issue that Abraham Lincoln did. We have at Mercury One a letter written by Abraham Lincoln as he is trying to figure out, how do I explain to people that slavery is wrong? Now think of that. How do I explain to people that slavery is wrong? We now know. We know it's wrong. And yet, we can't bring ourselves to look at it because it is so horrifically ugly. But I want you to know, if we really want to change things, not for us, but for our children and grandchildren, we cannot miss this opportunity to be an abolitionist now, because they're going to look back and say, well, your parents and your grandparents and your great-great-grandparents, they were putting up with this. Where were they then? Well, they were trying. Don't be considered an abolitionist in today's world. Be considered an abolitionist. Take a strong stand on something that we know is clearly wrong. And what you do when you stand up against it is clearly right.
Picture three empty boats floating in a harbor, pointed out to sea, with 60 kids lined up on the shore waiting to board. One by one, the kids step down into the boats. One little girl wears a Hello Kitty pajama top, and the rest of the kids, they seem to be dressed for a party. Thousands of people passing by see the kids this morning as they make their way through the town. But nobody really thought to ask, what's happening with all these kids and what party are they going to? Nobody saw the signs. Usually, the simple act of herding kids through town and unloading them onto a tour boat isn't that impressive. But if you have the eyes to see, today's journey by boat is a step back in time, loaded with meaning. These children, just like slaves of the past, have been forced to wear a happy face by their captors, five traffickers and a cocaine dealer, who stood about 20 yards away, laughing at the group of rich Americans. The scene lacks whips and shackles of the historic African coast, but make no mistake, this is a slave boat. The kids here are bought and sold just like they were in the past, a simple commodity. Once the kids strapped on their little life vest and sat down in the boats, their captains were instructed by the traffickers to launch. The traffickers and their American buyers follow by speedboat. And as it goes, the traffickers, perhaps in a hurry to get their cash, failed to notice the signs of mutiny all around them. What were those signs? Four armed Colombian officials dressed as boat captains. Five Americans snapping cell phone pictures and taking videos like drunk tourists. A camera-bearing drone circling just a few hundred yards overhead. And just out of view, three Colombian Navy boats awaiting the signal. This is Operation Underground Railroad. But the more poignant signs of mutiny were coming from the kids themselves. As one slave boat launched, an older girl on board huddled the kids together and prayed, "God, bring us home safe." On the second boat, a different girl wore a cut-off t-shirt with an image of Jesus printed on the front. A Hail Mary to any man, woman, or angel with a conscience and courage. And today, praise God, men and angels were listening. Within 30 minutes of disembarking onto the private island where the kids were preparing to meet their temporary masters, while they waited in one section of the house, on the other side, a deal was being made. Cash was being exchanged, and a signal was being given. Colombian Navy captains in raid gear drove their boats right onto the sand and stormed the beach. 40 kids emancipated. The rehabilitation and recovery experts were also there, trying to help the kids start that long journey to true freedom. But watching their captors march away in handcuffs at gunpoint was a pretty good start. As the American undercover operators walked back towards the boats, they heard what sounded like laughter at first. Then they realized the laughter had turned to cheers, as if to say, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." Since first announcing Operation Underground Railroad on the Blaze, you have funded fast, effective missions. Over 614 trafficking survivors have been rescued, and 260 monsters are behind bars. Slavery must stop now. If you haven't yet, become an abolitionist and join us at OurRescue.org.
Do you know how much one home break-in would cost you? Somebody breaks into your house. The average is $2,000, and that's what the FBI says the average property loss is just after one burglary. It could be more. That's somebody coming in and just grabbing and leaving. It's important that you protect your home, and you can protect it with Simply Safe Home Security. Simply Safe protects every door and every window in your home. You even get motion sensors and entry sensors. And their system is completely wireless, so you can set it up for yourself. You don't have to drill any holes. There's nobody coming into your house and trying to upsell you or anything else. And you have the professional alarm monitoring around the clock, ready to send the police. That is $15 a month. $15 a month. With Simply Safe, you are sure that your home and your things and your children are protected. Go to SimplySafeBeck.com. Get a special 10% discount when you order today. Or if you want the security system right away, visit your local Best Buy. You'll have your home protected by tonight. It's empowering you to protect yourself and your home. SimplySafeBeck.com. 10% off. SimplySafeBeck.com.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
Welcome to the program. So glad that you're here. Hey, there's a couple of things. We have to keep in our prayers the people in Puerto Rico. They are being devastated right now. The Category 4, it has washed up on shore. It started earlier today.
The president has declared that is a disaster area. They say that it will be uninhabitable for weeks, if not months. Puerto Rico is already on the verge of absolute collapse. So let's keep them in mind. Also, the last number I heard, and there's conflicting numbers, but the last number I heard was 240 people have been killed in the earthquake in Mexico.
You know, that's going a lot higher. I mean, that's just that almost immediately they had video of buildings collapsing completely.
Two schools collapsed.
I just hope, some of them got out. But they were talking about dozens and dozens and dozens of children that they know are missing, whether they're alive in the rubble or who knows.
But is there an aftershock coming? I mean, they had an 8.1 on the southern border of Mexico, 2 weeks ago, now a 7.1. I believe in 1985, an 8?
Yeah, I think
on the
it was
Richter
an
scale?
8 or an 8.1, yeah.
And that killed, it was, ironically, the 35th anniversary yesterday of the Mexico City earthquake that caused 10,000 people to die. And a lot of people had already gone to memorial services to remember their loved ones that had died 35 years later, earlier. And then later in the afternoon, they're hit with a 7.1.
It's moments, it's seriously like this, that you take a moment and thank God for capitalism. Because the capitalism we've had in our system has brought us enough freedom to make these disasters, when they do hit us, much less damaging.
Oh my gosh. Well, look at the difference between Mexico City in 85 and now.
Glenn Beck. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Pat Gray from Pat Gray Unchained on the Blaze Radio Network. Unleashed.
Whichever name is on the on your
chains,
network.
Chains, leashes, can... I had it all. I had all of it, and now it's been unned.
It's all been unned?
Yes.
So, Pat, what is on your mind today?
Well, I think we're going in the right direction in this country, and I think you have to agree when an entire Illinois football team of players 8 years old and younger takes a knee rather than stand for the national anthem, you know that it's going swimmingly.
Where did this happen?
Illinois.
Uh-huh. And they were 8 years old and below?
Yes.
Yeah, and they took a knee.
There's 7 and 8 year olds. The coach says, one of the kids asked me, did I see them protesting and rioting in St. Louis? The coach said, I said, yes. And do you know why they're doing it? Player answered, because black people are getting killed and nobody's going to jail. I mean, thank you for knowing that. Thank you for understanding that all black people are being killed, and the people who kill them just then, they don't, nothing happens to them.
That's not true.
In fact, in some cases, they're given awards.
No, it's not really true at all.
But there's the perception. So he thought it was a great teaching moment, and so they talked about Colin Kaepernick, which is interesting because Colin Kaepernick doesn't know why Colin Kaepernick is doing what he's doing.
It's very true.
So he circled up the team. They talked about it, and they said, "Well, can we do that?" He said, "Sure, yeah. As long as you know why you're doing it, I don't have a problem with it." With that, the whole team of all 25 players turned their back on the flag.
Did any
and took a knee.
Parent decide to have a vigorous conversation with the coach.
Here's the coach's quote, kind of along those lines: "As long as I have the support of my parents and team, and I'm covered by the First Amendment to peacefully protest and assemble, I'm fine with this." So apparently nobody complained. I mean,
can you imagine? Mm. You imagine you're taking your kid to into a game, mm-hmm. and you're sitting there in the stands, and here comes the Star Spangled Banner, and all of a sudden you see your kid take a knee.
I'd go out of my mind.
I would go out on the field.
I'd pull him out of the game immediately.
I would too. Yeah. I would go get my kid. And I would walk out on the field during the national anthem, mm-hmm. and I would go get my kid, and I would pull him up on his feet and say, after it was over, we're leaving.
and then we would get into the car, and then I would have a discussion later with the coach. The hell are you doing? Who? What right do you think you have to teach my children about this country and what we should be doing? Do you think my six-year-old really had an understanding on the ins and outs of what's happening in St. Louis? You really think so?
And is a Little League football game the proper forum for that kind of nonsense? It's not. You know, a guy called into the show yesterday, and I don't even remember what we were talking about at the time, but he said, "Pat, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but it's too late. Just don't worry about it. It's too late for this country." And I said, "You know, I just can't go there with you. I can't. No, I'm not going to adopt that defeatist attitude." By the end of the show, I'd adopted that defeatist attitude. He's right. You know what? I throw my hands up. It's too late.
You
We're done.
Defeated during the show.
Got defeated during the show with one stupid story after another. It's pretty hard to believe when you got this coach saying, "What I teach my kids is love, integrity, honesty, fairness, respect, boundaries, and of course hatred for America." I don't correct any of their misperceptions about what's going on in this country. As long as we're not going to teach our children, if we don't teach our children, we are done. It is too late. We got to get a grip on this. And if you don't homeschool your kids, you've got to at least supplement what they're hearing when they get home.
How?
Have to.
How?
Sitting around the dinner table and discussing what you learned that day. And then correcting the misperceptions. Talking about the news that comes on TV. Hey, when your kids say, "I saw what happened in St. Louis, what's going on there?" And you could give them the perspective that there are many people who think that all cops are racist. They're not. Sometimes they make terrible mistakes.
And sometimes they are racist. Sometimes they are racist.
And sometimes they might be racist. But in the vast majority of cases, they're not. And the vast majority of these cops have been exonerated from any wrongdoing. And I know people don't like that and they don't like to hear it. But there's also people who are doing hands up, don't shoot when that never happened in Ferguson.
Yeah. I mean, plus, talking to a six-year-old, you're not even in the position to explain racism in proper terms. They can't even just that's why they had the star-bellied sneeches from Dr. Seuss. Like, he's trying to explain racism, and he's got to put stars on the belly of sneeches to explain that concept. This is, you're saying, the concept of racism. Then you're trying to dissect, you know, national events and misleading these kids in massive ways.
It is so clear now that you have small children.
Star-bellied sneeches.
Yeah, there's no way 10 years ago you could have made a reference to star-bellied sneeches.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right.
So true.
You would have mocked us.
Yes. That's
you would have mocked us. Yes. And now we're sitting here going, yeah, wait until they become teenagers. And you'll be praying for the star-bellied sneeches to come and kill you.
I don't think they were violent creatures.
No, they were.
Oh, they were?
They were, yeah. Mm-hmm. Seuss, he covered all that up.
Yeah.
He covered it all up.
Yeah.
There was a horrible bloodbath.
Yeah.
Wait, I thought it was they all came together and understood that it's okay if one has a star on their belly and one does not.
No,
it doesn't matter. Those are just differences, and we can all come together.
Hands up, don't sneeze. That was completely erased. Yeah,
and then they were all decapitated.
Yeah,
so
and it turns into like a really tragic. Like a Hutu and Tutsi situation where they all start killing each other.
Millions dead.
Millions dead. I'm glad I didn't get to that chapter.
Yeah. In fact, the Hutu and Tutsis actually follow the playbook of star-bellied sneeches.
Really?
Yeah.
I just want you to listen to that.
That's where that came from.
I just want you to listen to that. Imagine that you had no idea who Dr. Seuss was. But you did know who the Hutus and the Sneeches or the Hutus and the Tutsis were. You would be worried right now about the star-bellied Sneeches.
That's true. Yeah. They kind of sound, it's a little scary. I would be infuriated by that though, because I mean, I just had a meeting. Speaking of having little kids, I had a basketball coach meeting last night where I had to go and like learn how to not. I guess I think that I would say the main thrust of the meeting was don't punch the kids in the face if they miss a shot. Like, they just want to make sure that you're not the crazy parent who's going to go nuts on the sidelines and become this competitive Pat Riley coach.
Wait. So you're going to be coaching?
Yes. I'm going to be coaching the basketball. And again, like, I already do the baseball thing, and we're starting the basketball thing. But that's, I would say, the thrust of the meeting is not necessarily like anything about the coaching. It's about like, hey, don't be a lunatic parent who thinks this is the Final Four. It's not. Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. However,
they didn't. I remember going through this with my daughter when she was young at in Connecticut at a T-ball game, and they didn't give that that speech to the parents,
mm-hmm.
and the parents were arguing at a T-ball game.
Yeah. The T-ball and game. Where they probably didn't even keep score.
No, they did. They did. Everyone continued to hit the T-ball. Everyone was not, you were not allowed to grab the ball and tag them out. So everyone hit the ball, ran around. Everyone got home. It was tied 8-8.
It was a home run every time.
It was a home run every time, tied 8-8. And there were parents that actually were arguing about it. And I turned around and went, it's going to be 8-8.
That is true. Because I did the baseball thing last year. And there's, you start just counting in your head, at least, the outs. Because every once in a while, the ball gets close enough to the base and the kid actually picks it up or throws it somewhat near the other kid.
Yeah.
And the guy running to first base trips and you get an out. And it's like basically winning the World Series.
Oh, the stands empty.
Yeah.
They tear down the fencing. Yeah. It's a big moment.
Gatorade baths come.
Right.
But I mean, I think honestly, there is no circumstance that I can imagine losing my mind as a parent for a Little League kid. Except the one you just described, Pat. I'd lose my mind on that. Not on the kid, obviously.
For sure.
But I mean, afterwards, and I wouldn't lose my mind on the kid, but there would be a harsh talking to on that one.
You know what? I don't think I would take it out on my child. There would be a discussion on. I understand. You thought you were doing good, but that's a really complex thing. I mean, if you come down on your kids when they think they're doing good and they've been told by an adult that they're doing good, they're going to have to decide eventually, who do they believe, mom and dad or my fun coach over here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as they grow, they're going to start thinking. So you wouldn't want to come down on your kid at all. You would want to correct it. But if they're 6 or 7 years old, they have no idea what they're doing.
None.
This, the one that's responsible is the coach. And I can't believe that in America today that could happen and there isn't a single parent on that Little League team on either side that isn't in front of a camera saying, this is outrageous. I pulled my kid out.
It shows you how out of favor conservative principles are.
No.
Nobody has them.
Stop.
Nobody has them.
Stop. Conservative principles. American principles.
That's right.
It's not conservative anymore. This is how out of step anyone who actually believes in America, how out of step you actually are.
Now, if you don't hate America, you can listen to Pat Gray Unleashed or watch it on the Blaze television and radio networks.
And if you don't do it, I'll find you.
Yeah,
I'll find you.
If you don't hate America, listen to him. If you do hate America, watch him.
Yeah. Right, whichever one. And see the fabulous path he will take today to be completely defeated and give up on America. that's all coming up on Pat Gray Unleashed after this program on Blaze Radio and TV.
As a gun owner, education is the top priority. A concealed carry permit allows you to do a lot of things, but the moment you pull out that gun, it's a different world. Who is protecting you? Do you guys remember when we went to Philadelphia and we took the classes and we all had to, you know, take the safety course classes and learn to shoot the guns?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Remember that? Mm-hmm. And remember the conversation that they had on, look, if you're ever going to pull out your gun, here are the rules, here are the restrictions, here's what you want to make sure. And we were all afraid, like, I'm not going to pull my gun. I mean, I don't want to pull my gun because it was so, there were certain things you had to do. Otherwise, your life is over.
And people who go through that training are usually the least likely to pull out their gun in some crazy circumstance because they're the most responsible.
And in some cases, in some states, there's a law that you must try to retreat first. You have to run away before you can then defend yourself.
Mm.
It doesn't even make sense in some places. Just unbelievable.
Here in the Texas, thank God, that's not the case. But pretty much everywhere else, you're in trouble. And even in Texas, you have to pull your gun on somebody. And God forbid you have to shoot. You're in trouble. The U.S. Concealed Carry Association knows this, and they would like to send you their free family defense guide. Now, this is really important. It covers everything, all the safety stuff, all of the things like, you know, how can you, see trouble coming? How can you detect attackers before they see you? I can't believe that we have to have a handbook, but you should have this handbook in your house on what do you do in case of a mass shooting? I don't understand this world, but that's part of it now. The critical thing is, beyond the 165 pages that you can either read or you can listen to it on their bonus audio version, they give you the checklist that you should have if you own a gun and you want to protect yourself. But to me, the most important thing is that you look into their insurance, because we have health insurance, we have life insurance, we have fire insurance, we have car insurance. Some people have flood insurance. I mean, we have insurance for everything but this. But the moment you pull your gun, you're going to need it, because somebody, the bad guys, this time wearing a suit and carrying a briefcase and calling themselves attorneys, are coming for you. ProtectAndDefend.com, the people who will stand behind you. ProtectAndDefend.com. Right now, you can get 100% instant free access to all of the stuff in the guide, and you should read it. It's protectanddefend.com, protectanddefend.com.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
My name is Glenn Beck. My executive producer is Stu Bergier. He is... also the executive producer of Glenn Beck Television, which airs on The Blaze. We are in the process now of doing something that I think you're really going to like, all chalkboard-based. But I think, in a way, when we get it all said and done, hopefully it's in a way that you've not seen before, and really explaining the basic things in a very clear and simple way, kind of the stuff that, you know, we're trying to go back to the basics, the things that we know that we do well and the things that we know that you could use. This week we've been showing you behind the scenes, and it's really quite last night's show. I was watching it last night and it was a little uncomfortable at times, because yeah. it is reality television. It was raw and honest.
Yeah. Last time was, you know, as we're building up to the new stuff, this was sort of like a behind the scenes episode where you're going through and talking about what new shows might be on The Blaze, specifically talking to Ali and Ali Stuckey and Lawrence Jones about their shows that they're working on now. And, you know, it was kind of in the meetings and dissecting every little bit of their performance and every idea that they had.
There was a time where it was like you saw me and how I critique people.
Yeah. You're a jerk, which is interesting. I don't think people knew that until last night.
Well, you did kind of cut out the spirit of it. I mean, I did say I noticed that there was cut out a lot of the stuff that, like, you're on it. I didn't have that conversation with them. You know, at the beginning, that's when I thought that they were on. I guess that makes it worse.
Yeah, actually, I I thought I made you look a lot better than in real life. This is the truth. Did not live here in that episode, because edited out you being a real jerk and just made you kind of a jerk.
Yeah,
because that was really as far as I could go.
Yeah. So if you ever want to see what it's like to work with me, boy, unfettered access. You can watch last night. So tonight is when I was working with the writers.
Yeah, the writers with theblaze.com, which is kind of interesting how that's changing as well.
Yeah, so check it out, theblaze.com/TV, tonight, 5 o'clock.
Glenn Beck.